This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got. Wildlife Control Supplies. Proven solutions for wildlife control. Delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company. Have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you.
Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everybody, this is Clint Locklear from Trapping Across America. I'm at the Predator Control Group compound in Traparitaville. If you don't know where that is, it's in Dunlap, Tennessee, God's country. And we're going to talk about a lot of different subjects today. Some of them's going to be a little different than we've talked about, really, because some of the questions that I've been getting, which I think is going to be pretty interesting. And before we do that, I want to talk about a couple of things. You know, the video library or whatever I'm calling this thing here is going to launch in a couple of weeks. I've decided there's some news about that. Probably for 1 month for Trapping Radio listeners only, I'm going to drop that price to probably $169 or something like that. And that way you can get all 24 of my videos for that price. So instead of spending close to $1,000, you can get it for $169 for 1 month. Once it goes to $199 after that point, that's just what it's going to be. Now, after talking to my web guy, everything's more freaking complicated than it's supposed to be when it comes to doing something like this. We think we have a way that you can make money on my video library. And we're going to discuss that in a way, but if you know other trappers or you get on other forums or different ways like that, we think that we have a way to do an affiliate link for anybody that has already bought the library. They can get a link, and if they get other people interested in buying that package, they will get money back, probably, you know, $35-$40 for just being kind of like a salesman. So if you're on all these forums and stuff like that, and you've got that link, you know, other trappers, you're at a convention and people complain about how expensive trapping videos are now, you can actually probably get all of my videos for free with just a little bit of work. So to me, that's pretty cool, and I thought I'd pass that along. Now, I do want to have a little bit of warning for you. Probably in the fall, late summer, I'm going to be doing a few podcasts on survival trapping and snaring, and more about myth busting the survival industry and all the craziness that goes on over there. Now, for you guys that don't know me very well, I've been a what you would call a prepper or a survivalist for a long time. It just seems to make sense for anybody that doesn't believe in outsourcing parts of their life to everybody else. Security is one of them, you know, food production. You know, that's part of the reason I grow a lot of my own stuff. I mean, you know, things shut the grocery store off for a year, I've got my own food. I'm not worried about it. If the National Guard Army up here runs out of ammunition, I can probably keep them going for a while. I've been set up like this for a long time. I don't really do a whole lot in that industry, but because of the web presence that I've got, I'm getting these questions, and it's kind of weird to me how somebody that claims to be experts in trapping are so ignorant when it actually comes to trapping. And there's a lot of guys, and you'll probably find some that's pretty interesting, because I'm going to put it in a little bit different format. And this actually rolls into some of the day show by some of these questions that I think you'll find pretty interesting. But one of the main things is guys that are relying on or thinking that the economy's going to correct again, which it's going to, guys. Stock market's just so completely out of whack to reality. It's completely decoupled from any type of production. So because of that, there will be another correction. How bad it'll be, I have no idea. I don't think it's going to be the end of the world or end of America, anything like that, but there will be a whole lot of people lose jobs, just like it was back in 2008. And I want to show people that through learning the art of actual real trapping and not, you know, mental masturbation, survival, trapping with sticks and a string and no knowledge of animals whatsoever, that you're going to go out and actually catch anything, that I want to have something to try to help some of those guys out that are really trying to be that. Plus, I really think it's an outreach program that trappers can do to actually fill the ranks just a little bit, because they want, I mean, guys that are into survival, they love being outside, they love seeing all that type stuff, and this is a way to get them where they could probably join the trapping ranks, which will just make us stronger. But what I think I can show them the difference between the nonsense of the quote experts in the trapping industry and never caught enough stuff to fill up a paper bag, when they're going out with all this craziness with their sticks and making figure fours and trying to catch a moose with a shoestring and all kind of nonsense like that, how actual trapping works, the different things. So there'll be some podcasts of that coming up. You'll probably find it pretty interesting, because I'm going to put it in a little bit different format, not just going out and catching stuff, but some other advantages that'll have to somebody if they find themselves without a job, or the economy does start getting kind of bad, or deflation or stuff like that comes in. The skill of a trapper during those times, if it does start getting bad, think about, like, you know, 29, the Great Depression, how really screwed up the country got. If someone had the skills, the know-how, and prepared for that to come out,
they could actually come out of a depression like that pretty wealthy. And that's kind of the way that I'm going to lead this conversation. We go to it. So when you hear some of these survival trapping and stuff come up here on Trapping Radio, you'll know what it's for, and you'll probably find it pretty interesting just because of the simple fact you're a trapper to begin with. But I do want to give a long ahead warning that that's coming. I'm not going to do like the Trapper and Predator where it turns into 90% Predator calling or nothing like that. This is not going to be a survivalist show. We're not going to be talking about how to purify water and all that other stuff. It's going to stay in the wheelhouse of trapping. Just for the simple fact, the information needs to get out there, and I think it's a really easy, low-hanging fruit to get some more people to come over to trapping, and the more people that's in it, the stronger it's going to be. So that's why you're going to be hearing some of that coming up in the future. Now, I've got some questions that I want to answer, and if you've got trapping questions that are specific, now what I mean by this, if you email me at Clint@WolferNation, I'll get your email. I try to answer all of them that I can. I can't get to all of them. There's just no way. But some of them, if they're very interesting or specific, and it's not so general, like how do I catch a coyote, but you can think of something very specific, you know, about how to, you know, where I know you're already thinking about something, I'll probably try to work that into a show in the future. So, you know, just Clint@WolferNation, you can send me these emails. Because the questions I get, a lot of times it's on stuff that I've done 10 years ago, and someone comes across it and they have a question, and I would never really think about doing a question like that. The first one is, this is from Bill. In your videos, in Randy Smith, Combines, and Couch, you show a POW auger. Maybe you could do a radio program on different types of augers, gas, electric, and where trappers can buy them. I'm looking at a steel, but don't know if there is something better. Now, I don't remember the show exactly, but if you go back through the archives of Trapping Radio, I did a show with Dustin Drew, which is now working for the state, being a trapper out in South Dakota, and he talked about a different auger than the steel, and he thought it was much better, and he said it was much cheaper. So you'll have to go back, and you'll have to find that for yourself if you're interested. Now, the one that I do use is a steel, and the abbreviation for it is BT45. So that's Bravo Tango a dash in 45. And the reason I use that one is it's light. It's not heavy. I'm going to talk a little bit about the fuel that I use in it, and it has different auger options, which I'm sure everybody that makes anything like this does, and it has a very sweet clutch in it. Now, to me, that's a big, big deal, because without the clutch, you can get in trouble. Now, the first time I saw somebody using this, I mean, this is not an original thing to me, so I don't want anybody to think I'm taking claim to this. The first time I saw this was probably 24 years ago. I was at a Tennessee Fur Harvest Trapping Convention, and me and a guy were staying up, and they had a Craig O'Gorman video in their library. I didn't know who Craig O'Gorman was. And this tall, lanky cowboy gets up and he's talking about getting sets done before season, already having he's using coal shell, putting it in the bed, going ahead and putting the stakes and everything in the traps under the shell. So when opening day comes, he can roll through an area really quick. So really all he's doing is he's going up, he's plugging the hole with grass so it's not so obvious. He takes the plug out, puts his lure and bait in there. He's already got his trap bed dug. It's already staked off. He's already got the dirt or the coal shell that he's going to be using to put over that trap. And he can put out traps in a hurry. And, you know, he pulls out, as he's showing this, one of those old-timey, great big, almost two-man augers off the back of this old Ford pickup truck. And I mean, he starts grinding these holes in, and I'm like thinking, this dude is nuts. Who in the world would drag around that thing? Now, back in the day, those were big, those were heavy, and they didn't have clutches. So if you hit a root or a rock, you better not be twisted up because something's coming out of joint or getting broke, or you're hitting the ground, you know, but it really helped him. And the other thing about the auger, guys, if you ever really, really get serious about numbers, the beauty of the auger, if you're going to do it like Craig did, where you got your first line already laid out, is you can go out and lay out your second, third, fourth lines with that auger and not spend a whole lot of energy. And then when you get done with that, you know, he pulls the traps and he goes to his next line and he's just repeating the easy part of that. So you can get a bunch of stuff out and you can move really quickly. Because a lot of times what hurts somebody that's trying to catch numbers, if that's what they want to do, or they're trying to make a living, if that's what they're trying to do when it comes to trapping, it's not so much the time that you got traps in the ground. There's this ugly little space in between that eats up so much of your season, and that's pulling traps and setting a new line. That right there is like the radiation zone when it comes to your trapping. And you need to try to figure out ways to make that easier. My way was going to drags and using the auger and stuff like that. Because if you keep records of how much time you spend moving and doing stuff like that, you'll see it's a big time waster. Because production is catching, not, you know, that's what you're there for, is to catch. Now, the other side of this is to get set up that way, it costs a lot more money. There's no doubt. Putting money inside of an auger at probably $450 to $500, that's a chunk of change to put down on something. You know, I found once I've got the auger, I use it all kind of ways. And then I use it on my permaculture farm, in my garden. I use it when I put in fence posts. You know, I use it, one of the things I really do with it, if you're into growing a garden or something like that, you know, you get done and you're skinning muskrats and you got possum carcasses and beaver and all that type stuff. Well, I can go out around my trees with that auger or my garden where the garden's going to be in the beds, and I drill these holes and I shove it full of that animal, put dirt on top of it. Because plants are meat eaters, no matter what vegan hippies want to tell you. They love meat, blood, and bones. And so that allows me to do that. So I've got a lot of different things I'm doing with this auger besides just trapping once I got using it. But it's a lot of money. And now, you're going to have to play the game. Is it worth your time and is it worth your energy to go get something like that? And that's something you're only going to be able to figure out. Because think about it. To me, it's more important for a trapper to have something like this if he's a part-time guy than a full-time guy. And I've said this before, and it's so true, guys. When I go out trapping, I go out in the morning, I stay all day, I come in when it's getting dark or with a headlight on or something like that. I've got all day. Now, I want to be as efficient as I can during that time. Now, back before I got to the part where I can trap full time, you know, I'm trapping on the way to work, I'm trapping after work, I'm pushing sets on the weekends, you know, I'm trying to run stuff during lunch. Time was way more precious. Now, see, time to me is more important than money. Time is the big deal that no one really thinks about when they're doing something, especially a hobby. So let's say that you're a hobby trapper and you've got an hour before work and you're wanting to go out and you're wanting to catch some stuff because that's why you're trapping. So you go out and you're digging holes with shovels and you're doing all this type of stuff. And to say in that 1 hour, you can get out 7 sets. Well, with an auger, you could probably get out 14 or 20 if you really pushed yourself. In the same amount of time, your production goes way, way higher. And it's not always about the money what I'm talking about. It's the value of the time, which a lot of guys don't put enough value on, I believe. So you go out and you can double your thing. Now, on the weekends, you can put in a lot more sets with an auger, again, with a shovel. So that just gives you, it's like doubling your time when you're out on the trap line. Now, this is where you're going to have to be honest with yourself. Does that matter to you personally? If running 7 sets is fine, or 10 sets a day, or putting in sets, or whatever you're doing, if that's perfectly fine with you, and it doesn't matter if your production goes up and your ground's easy to dig in and all this type of stuff, maybe the auger's not for you. I don't know. So, you know, keep that in mind. But it is a big chunk of money. Now, I've had my auger for, and this is the way a business person looks at any piece of equipment, I get more production, and the price of that thing is not, you don't look at equipment from a business point of view from a one-year time frame. I've had mine now for about 10 years, I think. It may be 11, but I think it's 10. I was trying to figure this up the other night. So I've got it for 10 years. I spent $500. That means when I itemize that over the 10 years, what it cost me to have that auger in production each year is $50. Now, $50 a year is not worth all that extra production and time and stuff like that. See, that really changes the equation on how you're going to look at this thing. So that makes a big difference on how you're going to look at it, but it's something you're going to have to come up with. Now, there are different augers out there, but there's some, like I said, on the steel, and I don't make anything from steel or anything like that, so I'm not just promoting them, for that reason whatsoever. I don't want you to think that. But the steel is light. It's very balanced. So when you grab it, you learn to grab it by the base of the handle up next to the machine head part of this thing, and it doesn't really take any energy to carry. The other thing is the clutch. With this right here on the BT45, the reason it does so good is that when you hit a rock and you hit a root, or you get in dirt that you can't dig in, the motor just doesn't have enough power to dig in it, the head stops without jerking the top of it. Now, if you're in churdy ground or you're around roots, trust me, that'll really save you some rough mornings. So when I'm digging, that thing's going in the ground, and I hit something, it just the head stops without twisting the top. So whatever you buy, whatever kind it is, make sure it's got a good clutch. You know, and if that will let you test one, go out and run it next to a tree so you can hit a root to see what it's going to do. Now, steel, you know, as far as I can tell, I'm not mechanical in that way, but it seems like it's a very good and very quality unit. After about the first 4 or 5 years, I'll give you a little hint that'll really help you if you get a power auger. You can go into Tractor Supply or an Ace Hardware or Home Depot or anything like that, and they've got these cans of fuel that are pre-mixed. It is 100% gasoline. Now, I don't think ethanol is the big bad guy that a lot of people make it out to be, but I can tell you when I was using the gas that I would get at the gas station and mix it, if I didn't use the auger for 2 or 3 months, it was a pain in the butt to get started. When I started going to this canned fuel, which runs about $6.99 or so for a quart, which is a lot of holes, trust me, that's more expensive than if I go buy it by the gallon. But I can set that auger down now. Once I've got this through the system completely, I can come back 6 months and in 2 or 3 cranks, I'm up and rolling. That never happened before. I now use that in all my weed eaters and stuff like that. Because there again, guys, I'm going back to the time being the bigger deal. Spending 40 minutes getting something started when it doesn't want to start, I'd rather just pick it up and start it. So if you're going to get one, I highly recommend you use the pre-mixed canned fuel, even though it's more expensive. Like I said, you know, over a course of a season, you may use 4 cans of that. Because an auger doesn't use a lot of fuel per hole. So it's not really that expensive when you think about it in that terms. Now, the other thing that I do like about the steel, which I'm sure this is the case on most any of the power augers you get, it's not hard to change out the bit. And the bits are pretty important. I've got a 2-inch and I've got a 4-inch bit. Now, if I'm strictly going after coyotes, I go with a 4-inch bit. It gives me a bigger area. You know, the hole's bigger. It looks more gnarly. If I wobble it out, I get a good 5 or 6 inch hole with it. You know, if the only time that doesn't work is if you're in really, really, I mean, solid red clay and you haven't had rain for a while, sometime the motor does not have enough butt to get it to go in the ground. So keep that in mind. If I know the ground's going to be hard and or I'm going to be around a lot of gray fox, I can switch over very simply to the the 2-inch, and a gray fox can't go down a 2-inch hole and steal your bait when it's 2 foot under the ground. Now, a 4 or 5-inch hole, a gray fox can climb in the hole, take your bait, and somehow never get caught. So around gray fox that is. Plus on the hard dirt with that smaller auger, you're not trying to move as much undisturbed soil, and it'll go down pretty quick. Now for you guys out there that just cannot stand to leave disposable stakes, if you had an auger, you can probably figure out to itemize this out over a year that it would make you money to have one, for the simple fact if you're using disposables with chain or with cable and you've got to get those out, you can take that auger, run it straight down the chain until you hit the actual the head of whatever disposable stakes. Like I'm using the Freedom Brand Wolf Fangs, but if you're using the Iowas or Duck Bills or whatever it is you're using, you can run that down next to it, disturb that soil, and then at worst you got to run it down the other side, but you can pull your stake back up without breaking your back or carrying around another piece of equipment to hog that thing out of the ground. You know, so that's one advantage from that. The other thing about the bits on the steel, and I don't know about other ones, but I can order the ends. So all I've got to do is two flathead screwdrivers. I take two screws out. I can flip the one over when it gets really dull. I've got a brand new edge, and that'll get you through a year. And then what I've gotten the habit of doing is every year I order new sets of bits. They're not very expensive, like $10 or something. And then I can put on brand new bits. And that just lets it go through the ground so much more like butter. Than once it gets dull, it gets really hard. And the way that they're designed, they stick out from the actual bit head. And if you try to sharpen it, it just doesn't work as well. So, and if you had something that you couldn't change the ends of the bit out, the parts that grind, that actually digs, I would say you'd be in a pickle. So, you know, those are some things to think about the auger. How you look at it, how you justify it. You know, whatever, instead of thinking about something like this, because instead of having a heathen mindset where you're only thinking about the moment where $500, oh my goodness. Well, if you're going to be trapping for the next 10 years, that's $50 a year. So that really changes your perspective of what it is. And it just makes life so much easier. Not saying you have to have one to be a good trapper, but if you're thinking about it, that may be a different way to put in perspective. Now, before the augers, I used a lot of drills. And, you know, back in the day, you know, an 18-volt drill was big. You know, it really was. I mean, that was expensive. It was big. The batteries didn't last very long. And you had issues with them. But they did work. And, you know, like you can call up F&T and probably anybody for that matter, and they'll have auger things for drills. Now, when you order one of these things, you need to ask, if they don't have it in their description, is it a 3/8 or is it a 1/2 inch bit? Because if you've got just a regular cordless drill that only uses 3/8 and you get an auger in the mail that uses 1/2 inch, you've got an issue. So you got to think about that. Now, those work pretty good in soil that's not very hard, you know, but you've got the battery issue. Most of them come with two. You can come home, you can charge them up while you're sleeping, you go back out. You're not probably going to get a full day's out of them. So what I've seen a lot of people do with these is even on four-wheelers, if you know what you're doing, you can do this, because I went trapping with a guy one time. He had two different chargers on his four-wheeler that would charge every time he would turn that thing on. But in a vehicle, you can get different, even if you had to go as far as getting a converter to put in your cigarette lighter, to convert it to 110 or 120, you could charge, always have a battery charging the whole time. Now, you're still going to get in the pickle every now and then, just because if you're burning in a bunch of holes, it's probably not going to charge just as fast, but that's okay. But, you know, the drills will work not like the steel, not anything like that. But, you know, if you've got good sandy, soft, loamy soil, you know, you can move some stuff. If you're dealing in farm country, you'll at least be able to get down to you hit the hard pan to where they're not plowing and different things like that. So that's a lot cheaper to use. You probably already have one. And now they've got, 60-volt drills that are probably strong enough to break your arm if you hit something. And they don't have the clutch, so you got to keep that in mind. They do, but not the same as the steel does. So just keep all this stuff in mind. Now, the price of them, I haven't looked this up, but at the local hardware store in town, which is Ace here in Dunlap, they had one in the shelf. And if I remember right, I walked out of there with the bit and the main unit itself for like $400. Well, they went up a little bit since then. Now, Ace is not the cheapest place to buy something. So if you're looking at getting one of these, I've known some friends that's bought them used on eBay and things and been very happy with them, because most people don't use them the way that I do. So they're really not hurt, and you can get them for about, you know, it seems to be about $2.99 or something like that with a bit. I would also look at Amazon and the different sites that have them. You know, you can just put in BT45s. Steel and just go through the different people that are marketing. You find sales, you can get all that type of stuff. So that's a pretty cool way to look at it, you know, as far as that. And you can probably save yourself $75 or $100 if you take your time and find it. Craigslist is another place, because most people don't use them. Now, I will tell you about a steel. There is some things you need to know about. For about 5 years, I had no issues whatsoever. And then I had, there's a little line that goes from the carburetor up there. That eventually will get hard and won't work right. So you have to replace it, but it's pretty cheap. Depending on how much you're going to use this, you know, you can go out and run 100 holes a day, probably every day of the week for 10 years, not have any issue. Now, this year, I planted 800 asparagus plants with the auger. And after one day of putting like 600 holes in, it burnt the clutch up. So everything has its limitations when you do that. Now, to fix the clutch, I was surprised. It was, I think it was $90-something for the parts and labor to get it in and put it on. So that still wasn't that bad, you know. But there is a limit to any mechanical device that you're going to be using. Would I recommend a trapper having one? Absolutely. You know, if it meets the criteria that you want to do, because it is such a cool thing and such a time-saving thing. And in the augers, once you get to it, using them, oh man, it will absolutely frustrate you to death not to have one. So I'm warning you, it's kind of like a you know, getting on some type of drug on the street. If you get one, you're always going to have one. And then if you've got to get away from it, all of a sudden digging holes just seems like it takes forever. Putting in trap beds take forever, you know, and stuff like that. So if you ever go down the road or you use a buddy's, you might as well accept you put the needle in your arm and you've shot up and you're going to be shooting up forever. So be careful when you're doing something like that. Now, the next two questions are pretty interesting to me. And they are about trapping in a way. And it's more about the lifestyle of being an outdoorsman than some things. But Jesse, he sent me a couple emails. One's on turtle trapping. And it says, for a future show maybe, he's talking about turtle trapping. What do you think of commercial fishing as seasonal work in the summer? Worth the time, or is it a dying career? I've talked to a few guys and some say if you live in the Mississippi, it's still good. But other places like Des Moines and small rivers, it's not the same as it used to be. Me personally, I've toyed with the idea of seasonally going to Illinois and commercial fishing Asian carp. Seems to be making decent money off the Asians. There are some here in South Iowa, but not like Illinois. Thanks for your thoughts. Jesse, commercial fishing to me, It's just like when it comes someone to be able to make money from a garden. Now, you can be the best gardener in the world, or you can be someone that knows how to make money in an okay garden, and the one that's maybe not as good a gardener, he's going to make 10 times as much money. And if you don't believe this, you can go online and type in at YouTube, Curtis Stone. He's up from Canada, makes $100,000 a year off like half an acre or something like that. He's spin farming. He's very smart on business. He's very good on his marketing. and it's very different. Now, that's $100,000 an acre. Now, when you talk to someone that, that has a commercial farm that grows corn, they're hoping to do about 150 profit after all inputs and existing cost expenses are taken out. You know, the tractors, the land payments, the insurance, the, you know, the fuel, the fertilizer, the corn, all that. Now, it's the same industry. One guy's wanting to make 150 per acre, so he needs a bunch of acres. Or you got someone like Curtis Stone that's doing $100,000 on probably less than an acre of actual production. Now, they're both farming. One's making money and one's making not. It's more about, excuse me, if you know how to make money than it is if it's a good thing to do or not. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story about so-called commercial fishing. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was over in Chattanooga, and we get a lot of floods here, and it's funny. Most people would go out fishing when it was nice, calm, clear water. The white people. Now, I was going over a 153 bridge in Chattanooga. And I noticed every single time that we had massive floods, and that's right below a dam. If you most of y'all have never been here. It's a great big hydraulic dam, TVA. And when we have these big flushes of water, they open all of the gates. And it is, you could not put a boat in it at that time. You would be an insane, should be in a mental hospital nutcase if you put a boat out anywhere within probably 2 miles of that dam. Because the current is unreal, you know, and it's flowing at such a high rate of speed. A regular, probably 40 horsepower on a John boat couldn't even go against the current. I mean, it is sickening how much water goes through there. But I kept noticing all of these black people, every time you had this water, would be all over the banks in a couple of places. So I knew we were getting a big rain. I had a day that I could goof around a little bit. So I drove over to Chattanooga and I wanted to see what they were doing. Now, the dam, you know, if you've ever been on the front side of those striper fishing or something, when they turn loose of that current, it goes straight down and it causes an eddy off to one side or the other, depending on the structure that's around it. Now, there's a creek that goes through Hickson, Tennessee, that comes out and meets the river. So you had this torrent of water going downstream of the Tennessee River, and then you had this smaller creek that didn't have the push of the turbines and opening all the floodgates right next to it. And it was pretty much slack water. And what these black people did is they would go down there and they would fish, and they really only fished during times of when they had the turbines on really high. So I went down there and I had my normal stuff. I figured there's fish and crappie or brim or something like that. And I go down my regular thing, and it's me and about 20 black people. Most of the black people were over the age of 50 and you know, super nice. And I'm sitting there watching them, and they're all using fly rods with reels on them. And they were catching, I mean, massive bluegill, crappie, shellcrackers, stuff like that. I'm talking big. And they were bringing in probably a fish every 2 or 3 minutes. And every one of them, except for a couple, had built these cages that were 3 feet by 2 feet with a door on top. And they would sit it right down in the water with just the top side of the water. And they had a little flip top on it. And they would catch one of those big crappie, they'd put it in the cage, they'd rebait, they'd go out, and they just repeat, 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 repeat. Well, I mean, I caught a bunch, you know, and they didn't know me from Adam, so, you know, you have a little conversation. Well, after about 3 or 4 times, I mean, I'm enjoying all the crappie and big bluegills and stuff like that. Well, I get to know one of them pretty well, you know, just as casual conversation. Trust me, this is going somewhere. And I would see him, he would fill up his basket, He would drag that thing up to his car. He would put it in the back of the car, and he had several coolers. He had two in his trunk and two in his back seat and one in his front seat with ice in them. And he would dump the fish in the coolers, and he'd come back down and he would fill up his basket. He'd go dump the fish. He'd fill up his basket. He'd go dump the fish. And once I got to know him a little bit, I kind of asked him about that, and he was pretty squirrely about it, you know, because, you know, I'm the only white guy down there. I've got short hair. You know, once you're in the military, you cannot not look like you've been in the military, just the way that you walk around or hold your head or something. I mean, I can tell someone's been in the military a mile away. And they didn't know if I was a game warden or whatever, but he finally figured out I wasn't, and this is what he was doing. Now, keep this in mind. Curtis Stone making $100,000 on an acre of ground, or a regular farmer wanting to make $150, $200 on an acre of ground. A commercial fisherman that sells wholesale, just like the corn farmer, is at the bottom end of the commodity market. And he's getting pennies on the dollar of the value of the product that he gets, kind of like fur. And then, you know, he's got to do a lot more volume to make the amount of money. Most commercial fishermen I know are going to be on the commodity side of things. They know that they can take it to a house, they dump them off, and they get a price per pound, and it's not very much, so they got to catch a whole bunch of them. And then that's how they make their money. Now, here's where I'm just going to be honest with everybody. What the black guy was doing was not legal, but it was ingenious from a business point of view. And before we go any farther, let me say this. I am a freedom-loving American. Regulations, when they're stupid, mean very little to me. Just because someone writes a law doesn't mean it comes from God. Because they can write a law tomorrow where it's okay to go rape 2-year-old girls, and just because it's legal doesn't make it right. So just because it's a law, I'm just saying. But what he was doing is people knew and could taste the difference of the fish they would buy at the store once they all went to commercial farming, which is a lot of what's going on. So you got these commercial farms, they're feeding them, you know, fish pellets. They're not getting a natural diet. They're really stacked into each other. There's a whole bunch of nitrates and stuff like that, which they probably didn't know about, which is kind of scary on the health scale. But that's what you go buy in the store. So what these black people were doing over in Chattanooga is they would go catch these fish. They would take them home. They would gut them. They would fillet some of them, and they would leave some of them with just the guts out of them. And inside their houses, they had fish markets. And people knew they had fish markets, the local people. I mean, they're not in the weld site saying, you know, a river caught game fish for sale or nothing like that. And I'm not saying you should do this, Jesse. I just want to put the difference in comparison of is commercial fishing good or not. So, and I asked him, and this was years ago, and he was selling those fish for $2 a pound because people wanted them. They were wild caught, and this was before all of the local craze that's going on in the country now. People just knew they were better fish, and that's what they would. And they would come, and they would buy. Some of them buy enough for dinner. Some of them buy enough to put in the freezer. And these guys made very good money. I couldn't really get he wasn't going to tell me exactly what it was, but just from him talking about the volume of fish he was moving, it sounded to me like that old black man was moving probably $30,000-$40,000 of fish a year out of his house. Now, in Tennessee, $40,000 is a big deal, especially back then. So, you know, at today's money, he's making $60,000, $65,000. USDA does not like that. They want it to go through a USDA processing plant, and that regulates all the fish that's being done to a commodity level. And that's kind of the game plan. These guys didn't play that game. Now, you may be saying, well, that's illegal. Well, it is. But if you want to do that and you had the customers, would commercial fishing be viable? Absolutely. And it's kind of like this when it comes to your mindset. Regardless of your religious beliefs, a prostitute that has a service to sell and she sells it voluntarily to a customer that wants to buy her service and pay her for her service because he wants to, that is a transaction between two adults. And that is a better transaction than most of the stuff that goes through USDA because it is coerced to keep everything at a commodity level. It is for the processors to make money, the wholesalers to make money, the stores to make money, and you can go on and on. Because like in farming, it's normally like 10 to 15% of what the actual value of the product is what the farmer gets. And it's the same thing on the fishing. Now, you may not want to go that way with it, but are there other things you can do with that fish that would bring you more value? Well, let's play a little game here for a minute. If I knew that I could move fish to people that wanted to buy fish, and it was just a sideline revenue stream where I might could move, you know, $300-$400 a week or whatever to people that want to do it, you know, cookouts or whatever, I probably would. But looking at it from a different value, is there a way, thinking of being a freedom thinking American, which is probably making some of you pretty nervous right now, but just hang with me. I would check your laws. If you have fish in a pond and you grow them from, you know, fry, and you grow them up, could you sell them commercially at that point? And then, can you sell a whole fish? Because most of the time, where you get in trouble at is the processing. That's where the government puts their boot of tyranny on everybody's throat. That's the choke point in the food system. They want you to go to a USDA inspected processing plant. A lot of states have different laws where they're for small farmers that you can get away with, like chickens. Like I can process up to 5,000 chickens from the farm without going to a USDA processing plant. 5,001, they all got to go to the USDA processing plant because it's a scale thing. You know, I would check some laws to see if there's any way that you could sell fish that you caught if it was on a smaller volume. And if you can, I would look at going to a restaurant or something like that and selling directly to chef. Skip all of the middlemen and go directly to where it is that you want to go. Some states, I have a feeling you can do this. Some states, I have a feeling that you can't. You know, but if you could. Now, from thinking about it from a purely freedom point of view, if I had a land that I could go put a pond on that would hold water, and then I went out and caught the fish, and I had receipts where I brought fry, like for crappie or carp, like what you're talking about doing, put those in the pond, and I could say they come from the pond and go sell the fish. I don't see nothing wrong with that, personally. You know, it's fish, for goodness sake. Stuff in the farms are no cleaner or no better shape than comes out of a river. No matter what anybody tells you, all that's pretty much propaganda. So that would be one way to do it. Now, you can tell I'm not a very big get on my knees and grovel regulations type guy. And everybody's going to have to figure out where their comfort zone is with this. So that's what I would look at. Can I sell those fish if I grew them? If I grew them, how are they going to know I didn't grow them if I've got receipts that I grew them? You know, don't play their game unless you have to. Now, the other thing with the fish, we've talked about it before, with Asian carp or anything else, especially not a game fish, could you turn that into some type of an animal treat? What would the value per pound be with that? Be pretty high. If you dehydrated the fish and Fido it liked it or the cats liked it or something like that, now that's very valuable to do because you're probably selling something that's going to be, you know, when you break it down per ounce, probably $10, $15 a pound, and now you're rocking and rolling. What about, there's a trout farm down here below me that somehow does not use a USDA processing plant, and he sells all the restaurants in Chattanooga, and I mean, he's famous for it. But what he does with all his scraps beyond that point is he rots them out and sells it for fish fertilizer for people's gardens. And people, he cannot keep enough of it. And the price per pound for gallon, you'd have to figure that out, but I bet you it's going to be a lot more than the commodity price of the regular fish. You know, so I hope you're kind of seeing where I'm going with this. Commercial fishing, or anything like that, the difference between a corn farmer and Curtis Stone, is the way that you go about the process of the business. It's not so much is the act of doing whatever it is you're doing that important. It's the other way around that makes it where it's viable or not. And so to me, is commercial fishing viable? Yeah. You know, just for my personal use here in Tennessee, you can get a commercial license. I think it's around $225 or $250 that allows me to use more hooks. I can use a certain type of nets. I can get away from I can use different type of traps. I can do things like that. So for me personally, for $225, and this is where if you change your mindset a little bit in life to being rich, to not being poor, things become a lot more clear to you. So $225 is what that cost. Now you go to a grocery store, I'm just guessing that a pound of catfish, it says $3 a pound. So 75 pounds of catfish, and you've already paid for your license and you've got a lot of free eat. Now, let's take that a step further. If you're eating the catfish, you're not buying something else. And if you're not buying something else, that means you just saved that money. So what would that be worth to you? I think it's pretty valuable, you know, just on that one aspect alone. And if you can get into some markets that you can sell commodity-wise to get a cash flow going, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're going to get into an enterprise like this, and for a trapper, anything you can do in the summer is a good deal. You know, I would really try to figure out some way to really study the laws. And the worst thing you want to do is call up somebody at the USDA and ask them if you can do something. You get a hold of the rules and you look them over, you have friends look them over, and you try to find different things. In one of the classes I learned in permaculture, Bill Mollison, which started, he was talking about, he grew up being a fisherman. You couldn't use fish traps in Australia, but you could use, I think it's called grunnel traps or something like that. It's a different type of fish, or some type of crab, but you would catch fish in them. The rule said you could use that. So he went and used them, and he caught fish. Of course, they tried to find him, and they said it was a fish trap. He said, no, it's not. It's this trap. This is a legal trap. Of course, in a couple of years, they changed the wording on there on him. But he got to go out, and it was perfectly legal what he was doing. So a lot of it has to do with how creative you are on how you're going to move a product. You know, as far as how much oil could you sell from Asian carps into the trapping market, I don't know. I know you could sell it to the garden trade. You could probably build a massive business off selling the oil and the bones and everything like that, and you could put in a test plot of a garden, show one with and one without, you know, do a little bit of marketing, stuff like that, you know, and you got, you know, Jesse's Super Plant Food, and the volume of that would probably be because when I run out of fish oil for myself, I use a stuff called Neptune's. It's a salmon oil. I think I pay $25 a gallon for it, you know, and it's not pure oil like we use in trapping. It's just all the crap mixed together, and they put some type of deodorizer, which I don't think you would need. But you could have a whole system you could sell somebody, how they, you know, they drill down a little hole, or you could even build this into a business. Now we're getting creative. See, this is fun to me. Now, let's say you had a business for people's gardens where if you had the auger that you were going to use in trapping so you can stack functions, and you knew that people were going to do this, they didn't want to use the chemicals, but they don't have time to build the compost, and they don't like the smell of manure on their yard. And you could probably get a service going up, even from landscaping down to food production, where you could come out in a day, punch in 100, 150 holes where their plants are going to go, have them mark them with flags, come up with a system. They're going to pay you to punch the holes. They're going to pay you to put your Jesse's super plant food in there. And then now you just doubled what you're doing and you can make more money. It's a convenience thing to the customer. And trust me, you start putting pieces of fish and fresh fish oil in a hole next to a plant. Stuff that comes out of a bag can't even compare, because you're going to have all that bacteria life going on where the chemical fertilizers are not. So you're going to kick the butt of anybody with commercial fertilizer, and you can probably sell it where it'll be cheaper. And if someone doesn't want to use chemicals the way people are now, you've got a ready-made business all from commercial fishing. Plus, you can eat a bunch of fish, save a bunch of money. And now we're getting into the mindset of we're not trying to be rich. We're just making sure we're never poor, you know, type thing going on. So do I think it's viable? That's totally up to you. Yes. If you're going to go the route that everybody else goes with it, it's going to be tough. Because I've heard a lot of guys, and I've known a lot of commercial fishermen, price goes way up and way down. And sometimes you're working for nothing, and sometimes you make some money. But that's because in the commodity system. You know, so this one way to think about that. And, you know, for a trapper, if you generate some money in the summer doing something like that that you really enjoy doing, how cool is it you don't have to worry about what gas prices are? You know, just saying. So, and your other question, this is from the same guy, and it's about turtle trapping. Now, commercial turtle trapping is very viable some years. Some years it's not. If you've never been around it, it's one of those things that you can make a lot of money on, or you cannot make any money on, just like anything else in life. There's nothing guaranteed. What happens in the turtle market, as close as I can tell, and I'm not the expert when it comes to the turtle market, but there seems to be two. You've got the meat market and you've got the baby market. And the turtle market seems to follow the same type of thing as the alpaca, you know, be rich growing alpaca on your farm thing. Now, when everybody quits buying alpacas, everybody goes broke, because there's really no market except getting other people to buy alpacas to be rich. You know, that type of thing. It seems like every 3 or 4 years, people quit turtle trapping, and people go, well, we can't get enough turtles, so we're going to start a turtle farm. They make some money in it. They expand the turtle farm, and then everybody around them knows they're growing turtles, and they think they must be making money. And just like the alpacas, all of a sudden everybody grows turtles. You know, they dig these ponds, they put these fences around it, they're buying turtles. When that's going on, dude, you can make a crap ton of money, because you're totally out of the commodity market on that. During that time frame, I've sold turtles, female turtles, for $3 a pound. Well, you're talking $30, $40 a turtle. You know, I mean, that's a pretty big deal. They will buy your males normally at a ratio of like 1-4, 1-5, something like that, because they need males, but they need more females. And this will run for a couple of years. Then everybody's in the turtle market. And then the whole thing collapses because there's a glut of turtles, so turtle meat drops. And everybody gets out of the business. And, you know, 5-6 years down the road, there's not anybody trapping turtles anymore because the glut's gone. And all of a sudden, they start racking up turtle farms. And it's just like this repeating process going on and on. So my advice is, instead of fighting the cycle, just work with the cycle. Be talking to people. When they start asking about females, you go work your butt off, you go catch a bunch of turtles, you make a bunch of money, and then once that kind of crashes, you put them back up. Now, before that cycle, because there's a pattern here, before people start going into the turtle farming craze, the meat gets higher because there's not as many people doing it because the turtle farms have crashed, if that makes sense. So you've got a window of 1 or 2 years where you can make pretty good money on just the meat. So like $1 a pound, $1.30 a pound. You know, you go out and you catch 1,000 pounds of turtles in 2 or 3 days, you make $1,000 in 2 or 3 days. You got to minus your expenses, of course. And then you can make some money. But there's going to be two or three years, once everybody gets into turtle farming, that you ain't gonna make no money whatsoever. Just accept that going in, play chess with this and not checkers, and then you're gonna pull out of that and let everybody else suffer, and you don't go put a bunch of expenses in and you wait for the thing to start. Because from what I understand right now, this is, we're in the time where no one's making any money at it, so it's not something I'd really look at. But it's something I'd be gearing up for when people start talking about females. Now, the other thing about turtles that's a big issue. Now, you being, I think, in Iowa, you know, you do have a good market or two there to sell those. There's guys that buy them. For the rest of you, if you're in Alabama and you find out the only place you can really sell turtles is going to be on the southern shore, Louisiana, New Jersey, or Iowa, you've got to take into account, you've got to get the turtles to the buyer. So if you're going to have to drive round trip of 1,500 miles to go deliver turtles, think about what that's going to do to your profit and the time and everything else like that. The market of the turtles a lot of times is what drives all that stuff kind of crazy. You know, if it's worth it or it's not. And if it's worth it or it's not is going to be, you know, what it is that you think that you need to make on that. When it's high, I mean, you can make a crap ton of money. When it's low, you barely paying gas if you're lucky, if you can even find a market. So before you get into turtle trapping, find a market. One of the things I did at one time, which I thought was a good deal and I learned that it wasn't, is I got hooked up with somebody out of Louisiana and they wanted just the turtle meat. And it was kind of crazy high. If I remember right, it's like $8 a pound or something like that. So I'm out catching turtles. I'm under the shade tree. And I'm putting all these turtles in these little buckets that he sent me because they were 1 pound buckets. And I'd put them in the freezer. And then once the freezer was full, I would take them down there. And it was a nice check. But what I found out from that was the time that I had in it, I would have been just as good off to sell it for $1 a pound whole and not have to do all the processing because of all of the time. But sometimes if you got big into the turtle thing, you may have to do something like that, you know. And it's just one of those things you have to learn. Most of these markets have patterns and stuff. And the smart play on most of this is to figure out what the patterns are. And when you're not making money, you pull back. And when you can make money, you go all in, and then you're willing to pull out as soon as you can't make the money that you could when you're going all in, and the pattern's in your favor, you know, and to do that. So, because food goes up and down. You know, most of the turtles end up going overseas. It would be kind of cool if someone could figure out how to get to, like some trappers or smaller dealers do, where they sell fur directly to the Chinese or Russians or something like that. If you could figure out, you know, you with a bunch of friends, if you can meet a certain demand where you sell directly and skip some people, you can make a whole lot more money in it that way. So, you know, when you're looking at it like that, you know, it can be very profitable. And most of this stuff, when you're dealing with anything in the outdoors world, it's big swings. It's just like fur. And, you know, the guys that seem to make it are two types. They're the ones that hang with it when it's low and they go with it when it's high, and it all kind of averages out and there's a lot of struggle in between on the low. Or you've got guys that see the pattern, they go with the pattern, and they use the pattern to their advantage. It's just like putting up fur. If prices are low and you store the fur, you just wait till it goes high and you sell it. You know, that's a very good strategy. That's what fur buyers do. A lot of fur buyers, that's exactly what they do. They don't mind low prices because they know they can buy something for $2 and sell it for $15 4 years down the road, which is going to smoke the stock market. So, you know, they're putting their money to use on something that's real. So, you know, just it's more of a mindset, Jesse, than it is anything else on how you're going about doing that and how creative you are and figuring out ways to get around the regulations, because they're designed, because the all these regulations you have on commercial fishing, it's not to protect the fish and all this, that, and the other. it's lobbyists from commercial fish farms that want there to be no commercial fishing so they can dominate the market completely. That's what the regulations are for. And since I know that, and you know that now, I don't look at those regulations the same anymore, because it's not anything about freedom or free market. It's about collusion and fascism. So that's the reason I don't really put a lot of strain into stuff like that. I see it as my job as an American to figure out how to get around it. So that's just my mindset on that. But, you know, guys, you know, the reason that I thought these were two important subjects. There's going to be a stock market correction this year, next year, something like that. It's got to. They seem to be getting worse historically. So how bad it's going to be, like I said, I don't think it's going to be the end of the world. There's not going to be, you know, something like a James Rawls book, you know, where it's a world without law or nothing like that. I don't think anything like that's going to happen. But it's going to put a lot of people in a lot of weird positions that they're not used to being in, because they outsource their whole income to somebody else, i.e. a job. Now, commercial fishing, beaver meat, turtles, frog legs, crawfish, all that stuff like that. The harder it happens with these corrections, because of the way that the government is doing our money now, and everything is global, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about the commercial fishing and the turtles, and we're going to be talking some about their survival trapping and snaring in the future, is I want you to be thinking ahead a little bit of what happens during those types of economies. Because a trapper, not to take advantage of, like, you know, like a used car dealer or something like that, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about being able to take care of yourself and your family in a way with skills that most people don't have. Because if food gets scarce, you know, food's already crazy high. You know, when I go to Walmart and a tomato is $2 a pound, that's high. Because, you know, 15 years ago, you know, they were like 50 cents a pound. And the way that that keeps creeping up, meat is crazy high. And what happens in every culture throughout history is when people have got to eat, even though people don't think it's still too easy to get food now and stuff like that. But as that gets harder and money gets tighter, they start looking for alternative ways to meet those needs, i.e. someone that knows how to go out and get stuff. So if the way these corrections keep happening, it's great skills to teach your kids. So if, you know, meat gets up to, I mean, you go buy a steak now, you're looking at, you know, $7-$9 a pound for decent meat. Well, when that gets up to $20 a pound, which it's going to, now beaver at $5 a pound to someone that wants to eat meat, even though they may not be used to it, but when it switches over, they kind of start thinking about stuff like that. Now you're talking about a beaver trapper that's got a product that's $5 a pound. 20 pounds of meat at $5 a pound, you can figure out that's pretty good freaking money. Now the same with crawfish and everything else, because to a smart business person, when the economy gets screwed up, and I think we're going to see this more and more as we go on in the future. Now, I'm not talking doom and gloom. It's just looking at the patterns of the world and the way that it is. If you're in a place that you can grow crawfish or go catch crawfish, and you can sell those crawfish for the old-timey prices, but you really have nothing in it, when it's all said and done, you'll be making quite a bit of money. Like going out to catch fish, if people are struggling to get stuff and people start finding out that you've got fish and they want to have a cookout or something like that, and they go to the store and catfish is $9 a pound and you got catfish for $5 a pound and you go out and you have a good time catching it, dude, you've got a ready-made business waiting on you doing outdoor skills. And it's just radical. Plus, the trap inside of all this is, as the price of food keeps going up, Like today, I've got to go help out a farmer where he just had 50% of his chicken flock killed in one night. So I'm going to go over and set some Freedom Brand traps for it on the dog proofs and some conibears. As the price of these animals in the end product gets much higher, the value of the trapper to the meat and the animal producers, even vegetables, you're talking about groundhogs going in and wiping out tomatoes and everything else, the value you have gets a lot higher. So people think that outdoor skills are going to go away. I don't think that's the case. I think they're going to come more and more valuable. So the guy that has these skills that can catch fish and catch turtles and catch coons and catch stuff like that is going to be way, way higher. And the way the food prices are going, because our wages don't match them, eventually there's going to be a flip, regardless of what the government says, where people are going to start looking for alternatives. Now, the people with it have those alternatives, which could be you, the outdoorsman trapper. Now you're set up to have a booming business. And it's not just something you're kind of doing in the shadows anymore. Now you're kind of like the go-to guy. And that's going to be a big bump. And just knowing that that's a possibility, guys. Like I said, I'm not talking doomsday here or anything like that. Just knowing when you look out through history, because when you look at the food prices and stuff in Europe, people don't eat as much meat over there because they can't afford it. But there's a lot of people that they take hunting. It's a lot different over there because they can afford to go hunting to get the meat. And it's a big deal to them to have some of that stuff. And America's eventually going to get that way, the way our policies are going. So if you can be the one to go get it without having to go into all the high price part of farming it, you know, you've cut all those expenses out and you still have a product that you can sell at a good price. So just keep that stuff in mind when you're thinking about your trapping. You know, it's things in our life are going to be changing. And as they're going to be changing, you can do one or two things, guys. You can whine and cry and be depressed and angry about it. Or you can sit back and go, okay, things are changing. How can I find opportunity inside of the changing and then go out and do it? Because most millionaires and stuff like that are made during depressions, not during booming times. You know, you go back through all of the depressions, most of the big money, stuff like the Kennedys, they got it all from making, liquor, you know. Why? Because the government screwed up something. Liquor became where you couldn't get it. They saw an opportunity and they started making it and they started selling speakeasies. And now their whole generations have been wealthy from that. Now, do I think you're going to do that from a trapping point of view? Probably not. But it could be the difference of really struggling and then really having a good lifestyle when everybody else is struggling. Because the skills you have as a trapper or a fisher or someone that knows how to hunt, someone knows how to grow food, different things like that, that'll set you apart. And even though people can watch YouTube videos about it, we all know this, watching how to do something is like watching a video from Michael Jordan shooting a free throw. He can tell you everything he's doing, but you're never going to shoot as good as Michael Jordan until you got years and years of experience. That years of experience in there that someone's going to have to try to get is the opportunity that I think trappers can take advantage of. And even today, if you had high-quality, well-processed fish with more upscale type customers around you, you probably already have a market there and you don't know it. Because that's what they're looking for. Wild-caught, no drugs, not confined, all that other stuff they're worried about, and there's no way for them to get it. So what the government is actually doing is they're setting up the market, even though they don't look at it this way, for guys that know how to do stuff to get the product for people that want to pay for it. Different way of thinking, but I think it's going to be an important way of thinking, probably in the you know, somewhere before most of us are dead anyway. And it's a different way to think from an outdoorsman view, how you make money from doing the skills and the things that you want to do. So just keep that stuff in mind and just mull it over. And then if, the more you think about it, if you think that makes sense and you don't think that I've completely lost my mind, maybe, you know, you can have, I don't know, 5 or 10 turtle nets sitting in the back, a couple extra rolls of snares, trout lines, all that, you know, reset up. I do. I can go into meat production in a moment's notice. If we get really screwed up on our money, one thing we're not going to do is try to figure out how to do it when we're on an empty stomach. We've got the food part covered. I can go catch whatever we need to catch and grow whatever we need to grow. And then we can figure out the rest, because when you're hungry, you make really stupid mistakes and it causes you to do stupid things that really hurt you in the long term. So just keep this stuff in mind. Like I said, you know, you don't have to turn into super survivalist or nothing like that, but just keep these things in mind and start thinking about things in a different way when it comes to the way that you're going to have the end product from something like commercial fishing or quasi-commercial fishing. World changes a little bit when you realize how much power you actually have, as long as you're willing to accept that you actually have it and deal with it. So y'all just think about that a while, and I'll see y'all next week on Trapping Radio.